The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I don't know why people have asked me here to speak about this subject. I tried to refuse it, I tried to get out of it, but they pestered me, more almost blackmailed me, so I'm here. Yet on the other hand, I must say that I have a kind of sadistic pleasure in speaking on a subject like this in America. I feel that is something which is very much neglected in America. Americans, well, you can come to Chicago and say, well, this is a wonderful city, one of the centers of the world. And he said, but Chicago hasn't produced anything. And I would say, but everybody in the world knows about the Chicago Blues except the white people in Chicago. And so I had a very great pleasure to speak a couple of years ago in the heart of the Deep South about the blues. And I still think one of the greatest honors and compliments I've ever had in my life is that after that lecture, rather Black Panther mentality, black boy came up to me and he says, that was a good lecture. I only hate to hear it from a white man. I would like to speak about something that I think that many of you should be know more of than I do. It's sung in the church at the corner of your own street, probably, or maybe two blocks away. Everybody knows that the black people in America came from Africa, and they came more specifically from that region which is the Gold Coast, from Nigeria, and so we hear something of a Nigeria song now. Nobody's, of course, surprised about the drums, the rhythm. But maybe you're surprised that it's such a calm, almost dirge-like song. Of course, well, there's one little thing missing in this, and that's the responsal singing. Very much of African music is a solo voice responded to by many people together, a choir. But we will hear that in the next example, because when these black people were brought over in America, of course, the main purpose was to work. And for the black people, of course, music, singing has always been something which is much more in the center of life than it has been ever for European or Eurasians or whatever you call them. So work songs were sung everywhere where black people were working, and this was of course responsible. You always hired a leader or you had a leader to lead the group in singing. There's one place where you still have the slave situation, and that is in prison camps, and this particular record was made in 1947 in a prison camp in Mississippi. Just one second. This is made on the spot. This is not made for a record company or so. This is just a field recording made on the spot. These people are cutting wood, and if I would put on the record later, a bit longer, then you would hear the chips going against the mic. Very interesting.
Thank you. got a bulldog, he weighs 500. In my backyard, Lord, in my backyard. I got a bulldog, weighs 500.
But we're interested this morning in religious music. What happened? These black people, and I'm talking now about the 17th century, the 18th century, the early days, these black people were given, preached the gospel when they came in this country, and many of them accepted this, and they went to the churches, and they loved the music that they heard in the churches. What did they hear in the churches? They heard the psalms as they were brought over by the Pilgrim Fathers. The psalms, which were particularly Calvinistic music, were sung very quickly, but there was something very interestingly which emerged exactly in the time that they began to go to this country. Many people didn't read so easily and maybe didn't have little songbooks, and so they did this way that there was somebody who lined it out first, so you had the line said and then the line sung. They call it lining out. And as it always goes in church matters, it persists even if it's not needed anymore. So it became a tradition. And then something very strange happened. It happened in this country, it happened in England, it happened in my own country. That the reason is that beauty was considered to be something of the devil, very sinful. So you can't have a beautiful, joyful song in the church. You got to be aware of your sins and so on. And so we got to sing slow. And we shouldn't sing very beautiful. So the result was of this, that the line was lined out and then sung very, 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 and so on. Slow, you see? Very, very slow. And now, to have a note that long is, of course, very difficult. So what they began to do is to embellish that note. They call it grace notes. It maybe goes back to medieval practices. But now the interesting thing is that if Dr. Schiefeld would do it in his way, that the girl who's sitting beside of him would do it in another way, and of course this gentleman would do it in another way again, and so the end result is a kind of rugged sound that goes like this. Now the black people loved it, because this was, for in their ears, responsible singing. First you have the soloist, and then you have the choir, and it had the same kind of dirge-like quality of the music in Africa, and it had the same kind of modes, because many of these songs are in the old church modes, and they felt completely at home with it. So to them, the psalms, as sung by these Puritans, were exactly the most African thing that they could find in this country, and they began to sing it profusely. There were some people who hated that way of singing, I think rightly, and one of them was Isaac Watts, and he made new hymns, and he gave new rhymes to the psalms, and so on and so on, and it's a tremendous success. In almost all hymnals, you find again and again songs by Isaac Watts, but he had a very low success as far as the way of singing was concerned, because they began to sing the Isaac Watts songs in the old way. And if you go to a black church today, you will hear this.
So, I'll take a thing up and sing in the old Dr. Watts.
Yes, Lord.
And I want everyone to raise their voice with me.
Amen.
I know the Lord, it hurts my cry.
That's the lining out. I know the Lord, he Ryan. That's the next. They line it out too.
Amen.
What do you do if you're at home doing the wash as a woman? Of course, you sing the psalms. But now the very interesting thing is that it becomes something like this. So you have Patty Roseman, that is just 2 years ago, somewhere in Mississippi, singing, I Heard the Voice of Jesus. Just hear how this woman, in this case an old woman, sings that song in her own home. In the same way, I would say, in the Dr. Watts way.
I heard the voice of Jesus sing, I heard the me and rest, come on.
So what many people would consider something which is a real Africanism, one of the most weirdest things that's part of American black music, comes from that most horrible type of the most mystical, out of the world, unbeauty, kind and beautiful kind of ways of singing the psalms as was done in the Puritan churches. It's a very interesting development. And so if you listen to somebody like gospel singer, pop singer, soul singer, whatever you may call her, Aretha Franklin singing Amazing Grace, well, then you hear something that you can say thankful for to those Puritans in a quite indirect way. That is one kind. The wonderful thing about American black music is that all the kinds that we're listening to, whether they are old or new, they are all heard in the same church and doing the same services sometimes. So you can hear living history. Of course, there was not only this. There were these black people, of course, were exposed to all kinds of sectarian things around them, and some of them also coincide with some of the things that they brought from home. And so you had the ring shouts. And a ring shout is something like this, sometimes was done on Saturday evening, that, yes, we must say one thing in between. These black people accepted the most fundamentalistic kind of Christianity, that means also the most legalistic kind of Christianity, and they were told that for a Christian, dancing is out. Now we're going to have a ring shout and people dance in a big circle. That's my ignorant way of expressing it, because you were not dancing, because dancing was defined as crossing your feet. So as long as you don't cross your feet, you're not dancing. If you ever look at a gospel group performing, you will see that they will move on stage very much, but they will never do this. If they do that, they're expelled out of church the next day because they've been dancing. You cannot be dancing, it's sinful. But as long as you do this, you can do anything. You see? So they walk around in a circle and they sing, and it might be something like this. They have a singer. So this is a little group of people singing. This has been recorded in 1934. It's a little group who is singing just to accompany the other people who do what we would call dancing, but we are ignorant. Maybe the last time that black people and white people came together on a more or less equal base was during the Great Revival in the 18th century in these camp meetings. And there, the Wesleyan songs were introduced, and everywhere where the Wesleyan things were introduced, there was much singing, and indeed here now, church singing was renewed. This might have had a great influence on the black people, and certainly in this type, something new has must evolved. We know very little about these things, really. What we know is that in the early 19th century, for several reasons that I'm not going into, the very real horrible slavery began, and a complete split between the churches, the black and white churches, occurred, and there was a complete cultural gap, and no white man would ever listen to a black person, and the black never had an opportunity to listen to the white, and not very much, really. So there were two cultures evolving, and we have testimonies of the early time for some white people who had the courage to listen to the black people, that they had wonderful songs, and they were different. They were different from their own songs. And I think that they have evolved out of the Wesleyan songs, but they soon got their complete own color. It is a real creative new thing. Also, there were, just in passing, a little secular songs growing, and so around the 1830s in America you get the minstrel shows where white people begin to imitate the black man, and this has been a constant feature of American life, that the Americans have always imitated the black man and never gave him his due. So the black man is doing something and the white man begins to blacken his face and play on the stage, and out of this have grown songs like Way Down Upon the Suwannee River and so on. Stephen Foster is one of the main composers of that type of song. Many of them were just stolen from the black man. In the 60s we have the Civil War, and when the Civil War is finished, some very idealistic Northerners begin to open up universities, schools for these black people. And as it often happened to institutions like that, very soon they run out of money because idealism doesn't pay. And so the Fisk University was in trouble in 1870, around that time. The principal was Mr. White. And Mr. White had found that his pupils, these black students, had beautiful voices and a vast repertoire of fantastic songs. And then he said to them, now you are freed. Now you are accepted citizens of the United States of America. You cannot sing any word that barbaric anymore. You can't do that. But I will take your songs and I will beautify them. And I will make them something that's acceptable. He began to Schubertize these songs and put them into print. And he made a beautiful choir. And with this choir, he went around first America and then Europe, and he introduced the Negro spiritual to the world. And every Negro spiritual, which is well known, Go Down Moses, Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. All these very well-known Negro spirituals were introduced by the Fisk Jubilee Singers in 1870 and on. I have recordings of the Fisk Jubilee Singers, but I just want you to hear now at this moment the Pace Jubilee Singers. It's out of the same tradition. This is in the 20s, Roll Jordan Roll. Of course, just to say one more word before we go on into this, there has been a great debate of what this is about. Some people have said these people are real Christians and their music is really Christian expression. Of course, many people have said, okay, that's fine, it's real Christianity, but we've just taught them in order to give them an escape. And so they give them a nice rosy idea of heaven so that they would accept their slavery better. I think that is not true. That is too superficial a way of talking. Some other people have said these songs are really songs of protest. They use the Christian words, but what they really talk about is fleeing. When they talk about Sweet Chariot and going with the chariot, of course, what they mean, it's a train that will bring them down to freedom. So it is the freedom train, and it is just using Christian words. I think that that's true, too. So both is true. You have very Christian songs. And now I understand that if you are a slave, that one of the most important things to think about, one of the most consoling things in the world is that you know that what happened to the Jewish people. And of course you begin to sing, go down Moses and tell old Pharaoh to let my people go. And I think that the prayers of those who sang these songs were fulfilled one day. And it is not just the riots that helped, rather they made the slavery more severe. But there is this thing. So if we have Roll Jordan Roll, of course it's full of all kinds of allusions and connotations and associations. It's, of course, the Jordan in the Bible. Of course, it's the river that you have to go over to the Promised Land. Of course, it is the way to heaven if you die. And it may have been very much the way to freedom in the here and now. So this is a Schubertized version of Negro spirituals. If you had a good voice and good luck, and the chance was given to you to develop your voice, you may become a concert singer. And somebody like that was Roland Hayes. Now, Roland Hayes was a fantastic singer of songs by Schubert, Brahms, and so on and so on. He had the misfortune to have a black face, so in the end, everybody kept clapping because he was black, and so he got to sing some Negro spirituals. And in this way, he became one of those who helped to introduce the Negro spiritual in the realm of the cultural snobbish concert goers. It sounds like this.
Yes, plenty good room, plenty good room, good room in my father's kingdom. Plenty good room, plenty good room, just choose your seat and sit down.
In this lecture, you will find that I'm a real racist, maybe in the reverse of most people's minds, what racism means. And so I'm very happy that I have this out of the way, because I really feel offended by this way of seeing the beautiful things that the black people have produced. And so I'd rather go and see what they do themselves. Well, there are many, many different things. Roughly speaking, my lecture is chronologically, I'm now in the mid-20s, And the other way, I try to introduce the development and the different kinds. So one very interesting kind is, yes, what do you do if you are going to, let's say, the barber and you have to wait so long? Well, what you do is singing, of course. And so very soon you sit down together with four or five people and you sing the songs and you sing the different popular songs of the day, or you sing songs out of your own tradition. And if you're black, very naturally you begin to sing these spirituals. Mostly this type of quartets is singing in the line of, let's say, the Fish Jubilee tradition, but blended with the popular songs of the day and then blended with their own traditions. And so you get something new, this barbershop quartets. Somebody said in the late 1920s, if you take the total black population and you divide it in two, you have the number of quartets that exist. One of them comes from Birmingham, and so they record it profusely, and so you have the Birmingham Jubilee Singers, and the text is to see the signs of judgment. It's very clear, I guess. And this is what I would call it, something very special. It is religious entertainment. It's not the word of my invention, it is their invention. It's religious entertainment. It is just light music, but based on those things. So here you have something out of the 20s. So many things coming directly out of the churches published on records. So records play a very important role in the development. As you have noticed, I haven't brought in almost anything before the phonograph period, because that's all theories and conjectures, and I just like to stay in the things that we can listen to. So in the 20s there are many, many records, and it's usually a record. These are the old 78 records, the small records, and usually there was on one side a little sermon, introduced by a little song and ended by a little song, usually, and on the other side they are just singing with the preacher introducing this. So these were preacher records, and you have many records. Reverend Gates had, I don't know how many. I have here one little record by the Reverend Weems. These things come out of Baltimore, out of Philadelphia, out of Washington, out of Birmingham, Atlanta, places like that, centers of Negro culture. Here you have the Reverend Weems, and he talks about, if I had my way, I'd tear the building down. The story is about Samson. Samson, who, you know the story with Delilah, we'll hear about it in a few moments, but the refrain is when, at the end of the story, Samson just tears the building down.
Brothers and sisters, I'm going to sing a song tonight. And the subject of this song is, if I had my wish,
yes,
I would tear the building down.
Yes.
That old building of sin that troubled the Christian's path.
Yes, sir.
I would tear it down.
Yes.
I want the whole congregation to sing with uplifted voices.
Yes.
If I had my wish, if I had my wish, if I had my wish, I would tear the building down.
Delia was a woman, she was fine and fair, pleasant looking with coal black hair. Delia, she gained old Samson's mind when he first saw the woman, she looked so fine. Whether he went to Timothy, I cannot tell, but the daughters of Timothy pleased Samson so well. Samson told his father just to go and see if you can get that beautiful woman for me. Crying, if I have my will, if I have my will, if I have my will, I would dare to deal and die. Samson went to...
In those days and today, if you are blind, almost the only way to make yourself a living is to become a musician. If you are a Christian, then you become a blind, itinerant evangelist, and you're singing song just the same. These two never mix. You can never have a blues singer who will sing a spiritual or a gospel song, or the other way around. These are two completely different worlds. We come back to that later. Around 1930, with good luck for us, there were made about 30 different little sites of a man called Blind Willie Johnson. These records were very popular. Then they were sold all over the country. Of course, when I say that, I mean in the black parts of the country, because nobody else ever listened to Blind Willie Johnson. But later on, some white men have tried to locate this person in the late 40s, and they found that he came from Texas, Dallas, Texas, and quite a few things have got known of him. He has a very interesting repertoire, different kinds of songs. There are some what I would call the prophetic songs, and that are the songs that I want you to listen to in a few moments. You have just hymns. You have different kinds of traditions. He even has different tunings to these different traditions. Must be a very interesting man to listen to. Has even sung some of these Dr. Watts hymns in a very beautiful way. But I want you to listen now to his rendering of If I Had My Way. I still have very bad feelings about this record, because once I edited this record to have it published, and I worked more than a week to get these words down. And then after that, I found the record you just heard, which is all so clear and nice. And I lost a week of my life to understand what this man is singing. But now it's very clear. And of course, you are American, so for you it's all easy. So here you have Blind Willie Johnson, If I Had My Way. It's reported that in 1929, a man was arrested singing in front of the courthouse in New Orleans, singing If I Had My Way. And there are good reasons to think that was Blind Willie Johnson.
Well, if I had my way.
Oh, yes, for people who don't know this, you know, you can sing. You can sing with a falsetto voice higher. You can also sing with a falsetto voice lower, which gives you a very special kind of expression. Blind Willie Johnson has a beautiful voice, does it here just to get this nitty-gritty, strong quality. It's not beautiful in Dr. Seifer's terminology, but it has all the aloofness, and therefore it's beautiful in my terminology.
If I had a wicked bond, if I had a Lord just built it down, well, Dollar was a woman, fine, fair, a pleasant looks, a coal black hair. Dollar gave no sounds in mind. I first saw the woman, I looked so fine. A wedding went Timothy, I can't tell. A daughter of Timothy, I play that well. A sound that told his father, go and go.
Me, Lord, if I had my way. Well, if I had a wicked one, if I had a long time to build it down. Well, Samson's mother replied to him, can't you find a woman of your kind in case Samson's way?
He also sings another song, which is called Jesus Coming Soon. And it is a song about a very great plague which was in America in 1918. It was the great plague of a flu which killed men by the thousands. So in the year of 1918, there was a mighty disease. It killed the people by the thousands. Oh Lord, is none like thee. And then it goes on and it says, why don't you turn back to the Lord and go away from your heathen way? So God is warning the nation. And so it becomes a real prophetic song. God is doing something. The flu is not just a flu.
I'm floating through the air, way until I got done warning.
Woman's voice is the woman that leads him, that's his wife, because he's a blind man.
The doctor, they got trouble, and they didn't know what to do. They gathered themselves together and called it vanishing flu. Wait until I got done warning, Jesus coming soon. Wait until I got done warning, Jesus coming soon. Died on the battlefield, died in the count too. Well, the captain's and the lieutenant, I don't know what to do. But I died, I got done warning, Jesus coming soon. When I died, I got done warning, Jesus coming soon. Well, God is warning the nation. He's a warning them every way to turn away from the evil and seek the Lord and pray. When I tell I got done warning, Jesus coming soon. When I tell I got done warning, Jesus coming soon. Well, I know.
The years between 1900 and 1930 were very, very strong creative years in the black community. And of course, jazz was created way down south in New Orleans and then later in Chicago and so on and so on. And the blues was introduced, and we get those prolific great singers like Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey and so on and so on and so on. And that new development, of course, had influence also on the religious music. And certainly, specifically, after 1929, when we had the Great Depression, of course, the black people were hit most. And many, many people understood that the Lord was doing something, and they turned back to the Lord. So we find that many of these performers become Christian. Sally Martin is one of them. She became a great singer in Chicago, and she introduced, together with Tommy Dorsey, that is Thomas A. Dorsey, a new kind of song, which we are going to call gospel song. Georgia Tom, as he was called before he started on his career as a very important man in the field of gospel song. That means they had in the 30s conventions, big gatherings of choirs, not like this, just little things, but you must understand that these conventions of choirs, that you had about 100 to 150 choirs coming together, each comprising, because, yes, there are so many choirs and so very much singing. And he just developed this and helped them. And he has been a very important man. He has been also the composer of very many beautiful songs. We will hear some of them today. One of the most well-known is Precious Lord, Hold My Hand. And I have a tape at home where he tells the story how this song was made in his own life story, and it's a very moving story. But in the 20s, this same man was a man who was a composer of blues. He was one of the accompanists of Ma Rainey, and in the late 20s, he made records of his own, which are noted for being kind of a little bit of allusive to certain things. Here you have Georgia Tom with Jane Lucas about fixing. It's fixing a water pipe, but it has all the double tongue that's in it. Let's listen to it. 1930.
Mister, want you fixing? What make you wait so long?
Get my tools ready, lady.
Mister, want you fixing? What makes you wait so long? If you don't want to fix it, tell me and I'll be moving on.
Now when I fix it, lady, sure will be mighty good. When I fix it, lady, you'll find it mighty good. I fixed a many of them all over this neighborhood.
You got your tools, mister. Everybody say your work is fine. You got your tools, mister. Everybody say your work is fine.
Yes, and that's what they tell me.
Don't have no pipe mixing. I want you to work on mine. Fix it up, mister. If it takes you all night long.
So, just very shortly after this, he began his career as a prolific writer of religious song, which became known as gospel. He became the trainer. He became the publisher of many of these songs. He became the promoter of many choirs and small choirs and big choirs. He became the teacher of people like Mahalia Jackson and many other people. And he became a very central figure. Together with Sally Martin, who had been a blues singer, he was promoting these new types of songs. There are very few records of him, because in a way that was not his thing. He was just a promoter. He was, of course, an organist in the church and so on too. But I just have one record, which is a rare one. It gives you an idea of the same man a couple of years later. This happened in Chicago, and this is not very beautiful, I'm quite aware of that, but it had a great influence. So for instance, you have singers like Rosetta Tharpe, who was a singer with a jazz band, and one day she converted, but she kept her contacts with the band, and in the intermission she would sit on the stage with her guitar and say, you don't like what I'm singing, but I'm singing about this, it's a matter not to drink. Or one of the songs that you will listen to now, you will hear the same song that I just introduced. It's a Georgia, it's a Thomas A. Dorsey song, but now sung by Rosetta Tharpe in 1938.
I have no need to fear. You just hide me in thy bosom. Tell us time of life is over. Cradle of thy love, all defeat. no more. Then you take me to your blessed home above. Make my journey brighter. You just make my burden lighter. Help me to do good wherever I can. Oh, let thy presence thrill me. Thy loving kindness fill me. Then you hold me in the hollow of thy hand.
In those years, in late 1930s, you had also, of course, the development of all those quartets, and many of these quartets developed into, well, they had some influence, of course, of these things that we have just been listening to, and little bits of it. And so you hear in 1938, Mitchell's Christian Singers. 1938 is a very important date, because in 1938 you had this concert in the Savoy Hall in New York, which marked the beginning of the revival of jazz and so on. So you had Benny Goodman and Count Basie and so on playing there. You had blues singers like Big Bill Brunzi and other people there. And you had the Mitchell Christian Singers. They are noted to have been there. And they made a deep impression. It was something like this. This is a song again by Thomas A. Dorsey. Precious Lord, take my hand.
Oh Lord, take my hand. Hear me out, humble and weak. My Lord alone, humble, bless all, Lord, do nothing. You leave me, Father.
In the next example, you will hear how you can compare this with the jazz in exactly the same time, and there must have been an influence to and fro. So this is a bluesy type of swing music, jazz, by the black people, Jimmy Lunsford. You had the same kinds of riffs and the same kind of sound, as it were. There's one thing that I think is one of the greatest tragedies of our century, that Christians have been very foolish. In 1920, one of the most wonderful kinds of music had been developed and were developing in New Orleans, the New Orleans jazz, and there are many reasons to think that this music was very, very much a Christian type of music, in many ways very much akin to Bach. But Christians, the white people, looked down because it was black, it was low, it was played, of course, in all kinds of what we could call nightclubs. Of course, that was the only way, place to play. But many of these people were very solid middle-class people who were really going to church on Sunday and who even prayed before they played. We have very, very moving accounts of this. For instance, King Oliver, the greatest of them, he died in the 30s out of poverty, but his letters are beautiful Christian witnesses. and there are quite a few more. But the white people look down on it. But the tragedy doesn't end there, because although the black Christians didn't look at it, because it was secular music and considered as such very sinful. After all, it was dance music, and dancing is sinful, so this must be sinful, so you never listen to it. Yet, nevertheless, we can have one glimpse of what we have missed. In 1940, there was a kind of revival of New Orleans jazz, beginning in at the West Coast by some white boys, and so you had the Yerba Bueno Jazz Band, and one day one of the great jazz musicians, who had been dug up, given a new pair of teeth and so on, and given a new trumpet, and there he was, Bunk Johnson, with the Yerba Bueno Jazz Band, playing in San Francisco in 1944. And then, at some recording session, they invited one of the main singers, religious singers, black religious singers of the city, Lottie Peavy, and he said, can't you sing with the band? And of course she said, no, you can't, that's sinful music. And then Bunk Johnson sang some spirituals or gospel songs, and he convinced her that she could do, and so we have two little sides of, I think, one of the most moving, beautiful things, just a glimpse of what might have been and what might have been one of the most important developments in the field of music and Christian music as such, if we hadn't been that foolish. If there was an adoption and an influence of jazz, it was also the type you just heard, which is a later development, and also a kind of secularization within that form, which we can't go into in this moment. So you have the other development rather than this development which really took place. And I'm saying and I'm repeating, I'm very sorry. When I move to the sky. I was told by somebody that there exist some kind of Christians in America that think that rhythm is sinful. Well, if you're of that kind, I'm not of your kind, and it's a good moment just to leave the room. We're going on with this wonderful music. Well, how can you make music without rhythm? It is something like a person without a heartbeat. That means a dead person. So here you have Archie Brownlee, one of those singers that we have in the 40s going around the country. They were world famous, that means known by all the black community, but not, of course, by the white community. They were world famous in their own right, and one of them, Archie Brownlee. These people came from Memphis, Birmingham, and of course of places like Philadelphia and Chicago and so on. Archie Brownlee with the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi. I never heard a man speak like this man. Behind it, it very much resembles the jazz of those days. Not New Orleans, but the other type we just heard. After that, I do something naughty, I just keep it going. So, listen carefully. I compare it with something else.
Since I am his and he is mine. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus is his name. Jesus, Jesus. Dries my tears, Jesus' name that calms my fears, Jesus' Savior.
The most intricate problems, why is that so different and what is the difference? And what's the reason for the difference? These two people, this man that you have just been listening to is Gene Brown, and he got his record out of a package of records which was called Sacred Sound Spectacular, and he seems to be a man which is very much over the radios and the Christian station radios in exactly this part of the country. So why is that? There's such a difference between such a man, who happens to be white, and the other man who happens to be black. You know that I'm a racist, so that would be a little answer, but it's too little, really. And so we try to find something. It is not just the question of, would not be very fair to say that the black people are always serious and the white people were commercial, because the blacks have also commercial music. You already talked about religious entertainment, and in the 40s, in the late 40s, and in, well, every time, you have this religious entertainment. And for instance, if you find a little group called the Swan Silvertone Singers, they came from West Virginia, out of the mine region. The Swan Silvertone Singers, you can know what you have to expect, and there are many, many little groups like that. You may imagine and ask yourself the question, where are these people singing? And nobody could give me the answer till I came myself in America in 1961, and I went to a black church somewhere in Brooklyn, and when I got out, I got some little piece of paper in my hand by somebody standing outside. And I went that evening to Jack Story's auditorium. Jack Story's auditorium was happening its 26th celebration. It was 26 years old. And I went there, and that's where I heard religious entertainment. I heard the Swan Silvertone Singers. I heard many, many other groups perform there that evening. It was a non-stop program starting at noon, midday, till noon, midnight. And so it was a 12-hour non-stop program. I didn't hear all the 12 hours, but some of it. And it was fantastic. I went around when I came back. It was only 20 minutes from Manhattan. And I asked all my friends there, writers about jazz music, people who knew all of black music, and nobody had ever heard about Jack Story's auditorium, although it was 26 years, for 26 years there, every Sunday night. Of course, as a black man, you're sitting at Sunday night in the auditorium, it means that you're not where you belong, that's in church, so it means that you're not a Christian in the churchy sense. The kind of music that you can have this is like this.
You know my
had a very light tone to it, although the song it talk, the things they talk about are very, very serious and deep, but the seriousness in a way taken away by this very lilting lightness, in a way too light.